This is Spectator Radio. If you'd like to subscribe to The Spectator, you can get 12 issues for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Just go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Well, thank you very much for that, ladies and gentlemen. It's a huge pleasure for both of us to see you all. Some months ago, The Spectator said to me that they would like me to do an event, and who would I like to do it with? And I said, I'm very used to doing events with my enemies and spend rather too much time with them and would like to spend the evening with a friend. And they said, anyone in particular? And I said, first choice, Roger Scruton. And a lot of things have happened since we agreed to get together with you all. Sir Roger and I have known each other for almost 20 years now, and we have a lot of things in common, a lot of common interests, a lot of common loves and pursuits, and some common enemies. And we could shoot the breeze for the whole evening, but we don't want to do that, because this is an incredibly serious time for our country, for the culture, and specifically for conservatism. And so we want to cover as much ground as possible tonight, and I'll say at the beginning that in this conversation there'll be three things in particular that I wanted to get to at least at some point before we'll hopefully come to you for some questions. I wanted us to discuss the meaning of conservatism, what it is now, what it is we're conserving. I wanted us to get on to one of the things which is on all of our minds at the moment, which is how we can find a way to have meaningful discussions about things we need to talk about in an age of Twitter. And thirdly, if we can get there, to the question that I think one might sum up as this prevailing ethos in our time where harmlessness has been elevated into the greatest virtue anyone should seek to attain. So, let's start with conservatism.
I was going to say that we should start with the last of those, because harmlessness is something that neither you nor I have any hope of attaining.
No.
However, yes, conservatism. I suppose I've made my career out of the futile attempt to define it and to make it into an intellectually respectable cause. I was brought up, of course, in the post-war period when ideas were in fairly short supply the conservative movement, and where socialism was being propagated as the natural philosophy of the human condition. So I set my mind to trying to define it and have constantly come back to it, even though, as you would know, conservatism is more an instinct than an idea. But it's the instinct that I think we all ultimately share, at least if we're happy in this world. It's the instinct to hold on to what we love, to protect it from degradation and violence, and to build our lives around it. And what that thing is, you know, is very varied, but it's, for us now in this country, it is at least the heritage of political order and our way of doing things, the natural way of being in this country where we belong and defending it as our home. And I think that is the ultimate root of the conservative position. And we all want the Conservative Party, I think, to represent that. And the fact is, less and less seems to, although I think most of the members of Parliament would like it to. And we have to ask ourselves why this is.
Why has it always seemed to be the losing side?
I think it's the losing side in the world of intellectuals and perhaps in the media too, because instincts are hard to discuss and even harder to defend. You know, if you're in the business of repudiating things, throwing things away, declaring your emancipation from your past, you get an audience pretty quickly and you easily find things to say. But if you're in the business of trying to defend what is your basic sense of belonging in this world, words quickly run out and you don't know how to do it. But nevertheless, when it comes to voting or making decisions for the family and whatever, the instinct prevails. And this is why, in the intellectual world, the left is always in the ascendant. Whereas in the real world, which I occasionally glimpse, the right is always the solid basis on which people stand.
Well, there is also that thing, isn't there, that the everywhere you go, the left's always demanding exactly the same things in lockstep. I mean, every country I go to, every continent in the world, there's always the same thing. The left is after the same set of demands in the same order. And conservatives are always conserving something slightly different in each place.
Yes. Well, obviously, different things are threatened in different places. I mean, you can't understand conservatism in France if you don't understand the extraordinary idea of the nation, which they have, La France, as the object of a kind of idolatry, which is the thing that steps in when everything else has failed. And even the left have to pretend to adore it.
What's the explanation for the situation we've always had in Britain, or at least have had for a long time, that where conservatives, parliamentary, let's say people in the parliamentary party, they seem to find it incredibly difficult to sustain their position in public. Quite often in private, they're quite bullish. And then in public, they can do free market. And then you see them starting to worry.
Yes. It's true. And I've often asked myself this. And I suppose I felt that I was failing them by not providing them those clinching, crisp arguments that they could come out with on the political stage and take the people with them. But the fact is, it's very hard for people who are rooted in instincts to be gripped by ideas, and they so that they will never take the people with them.
And a suspicion of ideas?
There's a suspicion of them, too. And you have to acknowledge that the left are very belligerent. You
know, oh, I acknowledge that.
And well, it's very hard to stand up and say that, actually, I don't agree with you.
Yes.
You know, because that's not the language of political debate that's acknowledged on the left. And this connects with, of course, what you were referring to earlier, the difficulty of installing a custom or a culture of discussion in the place of one of mob violence, not exactly violence, but hysterical unity around slogans. You know that, and I think you don't get. I've often thought this, that the left is very good at slogans. You know, march forward into the future. You know, and if you think what a slogan would be on the conservative side, it would be something like hesitate. You know, it doesn't work when it comes to.
No, I once saw an example of that. That one of the only protests I've turned up to, I remember years ago, and I was with a friend of mine from Northern Ireland, a few of us, and I can't remember what the protest was, but at some point we sort of all chanted something, and then we stopped. We sort of did it once, and I said to one of the friends, we're not very good at this, are we? And she said, well, Douglas, we our view is if you said something once, that's quite enough. And that's a difference of habit, isn't it?
It is.
I mean, I don't want to keep saying the same thing any more than you do.
It's also, though, it goes to the heart of what we think communication is. You know, if you think of communication as an exercise in respect for the other, you don't repeat yourself. Repeating yourself suggests that you're either demented, or that you you just don't care about the other person's response. You're prepared to override it and say the same thing again and again. Mm. There's no way in which a chanted slogan invites an answer.
No.
And I think that there's a whole politics of that kind which grows out of the mass movements on the left, but also invades the language of the left.
Both of us at different times in different ways have come across this problem of the fact that it seems to have become at least increasingly difficult to hold on to truths in public, to defend them. I've often thought this is something to do with certainly it's been exacerbated by the modern media, where everything is one person away all the time, so that the consequence of every statement can be put right before you. And so that people can hold on to very abstract ideas often, but find it hard to hold on to concrete ones in public. And then, hardest of all, riskiest of all, to be at all involved in the pursuit of truth for its own sake.
Yes. That's, of course, as we know, various people have argued that we live in a post-truth society, and point to obviously quite vivid examples like President Trump as illustrating this. But you know, there is no such thing actually as post-truth thinking. Truth is fundamental to the idea of thought. That's what thinking is, the attempt to get the true answer to something. So if you discard truth, there is nothing left except the pursuit of power, which means shouting in as high a tone as you can. And I think this is one thing that university students have to confront in the humanities, this idea that truth is somehow marginal or negotiable, that there isn't an absolute standard, but it's simply something that you use to embellish your arguments, as though you put flowers around their necks. You know, that is something that is preached by many of the gurus whom people study, yes. In particular Michel Foucault, who was so influential and still is, yes. in forming the new curriculum. The new curriculum is not about finding out the truth of what people have written, but finding the power that advances yes. behind it, so that you can confront it and be a hero of the left.
I have to say, I'm amazed by the move that's been done on this with the post-truth thing, because the people who complain about Donald Trump and others as being post-truth, and they've got a point, of course, but they are the very people themselves who pulled down the whole concept of truth. Mm. Every philosopher they admire deconstructed the idea of truth for decades.
Yes.
And at the very least, they enjoyed it or went along with it. They never opposed it. And this yes. is one of the things in your book, The Thinkers of the New Left, yeah. that you expose.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And, of course, exposing that doesn't do much good, because there isn't any way of exposing the fraud, the fraudulence of someone, if he really is fraudulent, because he's lost the capacity to perceive that. You know, and I think that institutionalized fraudulence is part of what we encounter in universities. If you see these, you know, denunciations, such as we've seen recently of the statistician in Cambridge who came up with the wrong research, Noah Kahle, he's called. You know, these denunciations are not founded upon any respect for truth. They're founded on the associations of people with the wrong thing.
Yes, adjacency it's now called.
Adjacency, right.
It's not enough that you have bad views. Yeah. You were standing adjacent to somebody who could be said to have bad views.
I think we're a pretty good manifestation of adjacency here, aren't we?
I don't know who comes off worst, yeah. but it's... By the way, your instigation for something I'm writing at the moment, I finally went back and read some of the texts that I felt I should have done many years ago. I finally read Foucault last year, and I have to say, I'm so appalled still. Mm. I mean, I'm a bit of a pub bore on this, actually, because I'd read about it, I'd heard about it, I'd always known I sort of instinctively slightly disliked it, but the catastrophe of what he does, the sort of perversion of all life, it's brilliant, of course, and filled with resonant phrases and so on, but this perversion of life as being solely about power, and the ignoring of every other human instinct, the total ignoring of love, the total ignoring of forgiveness, power, only power.
Yeah.
And you need to find where it is, squeeze it out of those people and drink up some of the juice yourself. And that this has been imbibed by now a couple of generations of students.
Absolutely.
I feel and like I was late to it. But
it fuels all the causes of the day because whatever the cause is, feminism or transgenderism or whatever, it is about emancipating an oppressed group from the domination of the oppressor. And this might be exactly the wrong way of looking at it. I personally think that the emancipation of women in the political sphere is obviously a great benefit to them. But to think that they should be emancipated from man as such, and to undermine the relation between the sexes in that way, it is, as you say, putting power in the place of love. It's one of the hard things, again, for going back to your original question about defining and defending conservatism. It's very hard to propose a philosophy that is based on love rather than on resentment or hatred. Because love is a personal thing that you don't want to talk about. You don't want to put it on display. And if you do so, it sounds, kitsch, sentimental. It doesn't have the right political feel. Whereas hatred and resentment, the sense that things are being, that you're being excluded from things, that things are oppressing you and must be torn down, that is an easy thing to form into a political movement. And I suspect this is part of what makes it so difficult to express conservatism in public.
But some forms of love are, I mean, I agree, nobody wants people to get too icky in public, but some forms of love, people are, I think, very welcoming to, at least some people are, to people expressing it. Love of country, it's tricky, there's definitely places you wouldn't do it.
Not in a university.
No. I've wondered often about this with the... resentment is, as you say, such an incredibly strong tool.
Yes.
It's an unbelievably strong weapon to bring to the fight. And one of the things, just returning quickly to this issue with conservatism, that always strikes me is that we do have equal weapons. Mm. It's just that nobody wants to wield them. I think an example I've given to you in private before is that I've often thought that there's almost as if both political sides have, as it were, a box of dangerous things that they know they can call upon, they know they can open it and use if needed, sort of with a hammer, break this in case of political emergency. And the left have obviously resentment, class hatred, and many other forms of resentment, and they are pulling it out, they're letting things off, they're seeing flares go off, sometimes they go and take somebody out and they don't apologize, and then they have got total run of their box.
Yes.
And on the right, there is a box of useful things, which again can go wrong, but may also be the thing you need most if you're going to win any political fight, and it's chained, it's covered in a rug, we pretend it isn't there, and yet it would seem to me that the thing most obviously in that box is precisely this, love of country, love of society, love of the things you have, not wanting to change them unrecognizably or carry out a political experiment for a nirvana you haven't quite imagined yet. And we do have that. And just a final thought on that, if I may, which is that, I might be breaking a confidence now, but hell, why not? But, I mean, I was recently at something with a Conservative MP, and somebody asked a very good question of this Conservative. They pointed to somebody in the room who was, it was a dinner, and somebody was serving some wine, and somebody pointed to this young man and said, "How old are you?" He said, 24 or something. And this person said, "Do you own a house?" He said, "No." He said, "Do you think you'll ever own a house?" He said, "No." And the interviewer turned to his politician and said, "So what do you say to him?" Very good question. Very pertinent question for everyone. And the response was fine. It was brownfield sites featured prominently in the answer. And I just could have wept because, as I said to this person afterwards, you know, the left is coming at us with everything they have and you're giving us brownfield sites? That's not going to do it. The left is promising him everything if he votes for them, and you're offering him this possibility of a huge mortgage at some point in the future way out of town. Who's going to win? But we do have things.
Yes. Well, the particular issue in question is one about which I'm quite an expert now.
Yes.
I would say that there is a clear answer to the housing crisis, which is to build more beautifully so that people cease to object. And then you can build anywhere. Nobody would object if you built Bath again in the middle of the countryside. But that would require, first of all... It would require an ongoing battle against the architects, the volume builders, and all the vested interests that align themselves behind them. But that could be done, and let's face it, it was being done until this fatal discovery that there was a Conservative in the midst of it.
Before we get on to the nature of that fatal discovery... What is the problem with the house building on this? Because you spent many months looking into it. You spent a lifetime thinking about architecture and aesthetics. But what were the main things that struck you in the months you were dedicated solely to this?
Well, the first of all, that because we have an adversarial planning system in which all people can take part and raise their objections, which is a very healthy thing democratically, we also have the consequence that those who have most to lose from a new development, or think they have most to lose, will gang up against the developers. And so we have a massive resistance to the building of new housing schemes from people whose amenities and environment will be taken away by them. Because so much of what is built now, and especially in the centres of our towns, you know, the square, the cubes of glass that are dropping everywhere, these things are not just hateful to people, but they are destructive of their sense of home. They make real places into non-places. And that's what's happening in all our developments. And the reason being things are not designed as places. There are economic reasons for this, there are stylistic reasons, and there's a general growth of ignorance about what architecture really is. Architecture means the building of a genuine home, a place where you can belong. And you can't belong in a place if others don't belong there too. So the solution is to make places and not drop little boxes everywhere or glass cubes in the towns. And we have so many examples of places. All our old towns are lovely places where people want to be. There's no reason why it couldn't be done again. And that would be the answer. People would, after a while, say, yes, of course, we can't object. And more people recognize that we shouldn't object to providing housing for the people who haven't got it. So there is a solution, but it requires confrontation with vested interests, like everything else, and an awful lot of those vested interests are connected to the Conservative Party, it has to be said.
Individuals or the party as a whole?
That's a great question. My investigations were cut peremptorily short.
Could you continue in an independent capacity?
I think that might be the right solution.
Yes.
Yeah.
That sort of brings us naturally on, by the way, to, I think this is the first time you've done anything in public since this all broke. Can I just ask, I mean, both of us are pretty private people in all sorts of ways, but what was it like having the mob actually just come right at you?
Well, it was horrible. Because there's no holds barred, you know. I was reminded, actually, of the theory that René Girard, the French philosopher and anthropologist, produces to explain the scapegoat phenomenon. His view is that at the heart of every society there are these huge tensions caused by the fact that others have what you want, essentially, and that you've been excluded from what you deserve, etc. These tensions build up, and they've been building up in our society, as we know, radically recently because of the Remainer-Leaver conflict and all that. And there's a need for a victim to persecute when that happens. You single him out, and it's necessary that he should be innocent. If he's actually guilty of something, then you can't pour all your venom into him. So he is the lamb led to the slaughter. And, of course, we have the great example in Christ, whose crucifixion would have meant nothing if he weren't actually innocent. And the pursuit of the scapegoat for Girard is the way in which the society relieves itself of this burden of mutual resentment growing within it. And you feel that. I mean, I don't want to compare myself with Christ and all the great people who
noted
and all the real scapegoats of the past. But if you look back at it, you can see in a small way how this process emerges. It has to single out a victim. I've singled myself out by having the impertinence to defend the conservative worldview. You know, that makes me a natural victim. And most of the people who want to attack me would not have had the patience to read anything that I've written, or the ability, probably. but nevertheless, social media provide them, these people who ought not to have a voice, with a voice. And there they are at it. I don't look at the social media thing, but unfortunately politicians do. And this is a new thing to me. Every school teacher knows that children ought to be told to leave their phones outside the classroom. Yeah. But nobody tells the politicians to leave their phones outside Parliament. Mm. So they're in there, attached to these screens in which only sound bites and words are passing. And the great thing about the Twitter sphere is that it's words that are picked out. Most of the people who are attacking me, from what I heard, were attacking words. Didn't you use this word? And of course, that's what happens when people are incapable of formulating a whole sentence.
There was a moment when the mob first came for you unsuccessfully last, was it October, when your appointment was announced, and there's a very forgettable Labour front bencher called... Actually, it's gone. He's called Andrew something?
Lang.
Got a horrible little beard like this. He's low grade even for the talent on the bench that he's on. And he said at one point, somebody had put to him a few things that you said, and he said that somebody with your views, I think he said, had no place in modern society. And I thought this was an overreach even for them, and pointed out that in future we're going to have to go to the Labour front bench for its views on Hegel and Kant and Spinoza, and we're going to be in trouble. But there is this extraordinary thing. It happened with the unfortunate young man who was your interviewer for the New Statesman on that hit job piece, And it happened with the Labour front bench and others, which is instead of regarding books as being a very good way, for instance, to work out what their author thinks, you can skip that stage and go straight to the... You don't even have to get to the word. It's worse than the word now. Now you have the dog whistle. You know, there are words which used to mean one thing, but now mean a different thing if you hear them in a particular tone that everyone else can't hear, but I'm going to interpret to you by hearing it in a particular way. Of course, if you do hear the whistle, you're the dog, but they haven't worked that bit out yet. It's a shortcut to everything, but one of the things, as we get on to this, is, I mean, this is causing the deracination of public thought as well as public life. It's why we have people in politics like this eminently forgettable Labour front bencher, and I might say, I'm sure you wouldn't, the Conservative minister who dispensed with your services without bothering to read what you'd said. It's why we've got them, but I'm less concerned about them than the fact that the thing that has produced them is still going on. This bit, and I mean, we were both in Cambridge the other month with Jordan Peterson, and I think it was Jordan who mentioned then this issue about harmlessness. Because this does seem to be, in politics and in everyone's life, the great aspiration to live your life as a harmless individual, to harm nothing and no one, to say nothing with the language you use, to express no ideas, and to die having harmed nothing. And it's just, it seems to me, an extraordinary aspiration.
Yes. Well, to me, you are completely harmless, Douglas. I've always thought so. But the point is, it's not just harmlessness that's being recommended, but the advertisement of your harmlessness. And now that's something you'd never do. Confronting the world with this self-consciously harmless posture is actually a form of narcissism.
Yes.
It's saying, "Love me. There's nothing to lose, and keep your distance. Don't aggress. Etc." So it's a way of proceeding through the world surrounded by a cocoon of self-love, and that's an easy way forward. But of course it involves renouncing the things on which the value of life really depends, namely giving to others, going out to others, taking risks in order to engage with them in real ways, of which love is one, and indignation another, and so on. There's a complete corruption of the relationship between I and you. Everybody becomes a neutral it, this harmless thing drifting through the sphere of mist, and that is all. It has a deep cultural significance. It's not for you or for me to do anything to change this, except to set an example. To say, look, life can be quite different from that. It can be interesting and exciting. It can involve the giving of things to others, and if you give to others, you receive from them. There's a whole world out there, and all you have to do is turn away from that dark corner where you're alone with your screen and look out of the window. I think this is one of the problems, that people are forgetting that there is a real meaning to life, and that is in the relations with others. And I think, going back to what you were worrying about, the collapse of public discourse, I remember the time when people on the left wrote books, and we criticized them, and we wrote books and they criticized them, and sometimes we had meetings together where we discussed them. It was wonderful. And, actually, it still goes on. One member of Parliament, John Cruddas, a Labour member, has written a very interesting book from a sort of revised William Morris Marxist viewpoint on our society in the old Labour way. And I attended all the meetings where we discussed this, because he had the kind of mind which reflects on things and which recognizes that opposition is not a negative thing. It's the positive thing from which further understanding grows. Mm. And if all our MPs were like that, and I think some of the Conservatives are like that, Jesse Norman is like that, for instance, we would be able to revive the culture of public discussion. But as I say, it means they should leave their phones outside Parliament.
Mm. I mean, you can't have a... You can't... The thing it seems to me is, if anyone's ever tried it, even in a room of three people, if there's one person who will not allow a thought to go in a particular direction, even if it's true, then the others can't do it either.
Yes.
And if you live in a society where one person in the world can claim that right... which may be where we are, it becomes almost impossible.
That is true. But I think one should also remember that there are many historical precedents for this. You know, look back to the 17th century and the Puritan sort of revivals in our country. You'll realize that those were times when the wrong word meant death. There's plenty of parts of the world where that still is the case. The default position of human beings is orthodoxy, because orthodoxy is safe. Mm. You know, you have to ask yourself, why are heretics so fiercely punished? You know, it's not the real opponent who's punished, the person from some other religion or some outside the tribe, so to speak. It's the person who agrees with you about everything except the one little detail, you know, whether the sign of the cross should be made with two fingers or three, as in the Russian old believers catastrophe. You know, these things go deep in our social nature, as does the scapegoating phenomenon, and we should always remember that and beware of it. We must find a way not to provoke it, but still to create that sphere of free discussion which is protected from it. That's what we had in this country, that's what the Enlightenment gave to Europe as a whole, that ability to create a sphere of free discussion in which we actually consider our problems rationally and find a solution to them. But as you know, there's so many of our problems today where one side has monopolized the language, so heretical thought becomes inexpressible. And this was beautifully caricatured by Orwell in 1984. But, you know, I was just reading an article in a French journal about the way in which Macron's speeches all conform to the syntax of 1984.
Mm. Yes. Part of this, of course, you've just... we'll come out to the audience in a minute, a part of this, what you've just described, though, the legacy that we have had in this country, which some of us are very proud of, this legacy of free thought, free expression, allowing a certain amount of heresy, these are parts of tradition you can be proud of or you can wish to repudiate. And you coined the term some time ago, the culture of repudiation, and which elegantly sums up precisely this thing, where everything you've inherited is what you are against. It was put to me a few days ago by a young woman in Germany. I was speaking in Berlin, who said, this is a nice way of putting it. She said, everyone of my generation travels to the Far East to see lots of temples, but I never see them at our cathedrals. And I said to her, of course, it's an oddity, this desire to go all the way around the world, but never to pay attention to what's yours in front of you, right on your doorstep. You never see people doing holidays around the cathedrals of Europe in their gap years, which is odd when you think about it, because why wouldn't they? I mean, I'm not saying it's an either-or, but it's strange to go to Siem Reap if you've never been to Chartres.
Yes, I think, though, there is obviously this culture of repudiation all around us, And if that's all there was, we would feel despair. But I actually think that there is also an impulse to renew, which is in everybody. And you see this with young people who go, for instance, to study in Oxford or Cambridge, how keen they are to join the college choir, how they actually enjoy the atmosphere of the hall and the formalities and the sense of belonging to a continuous tradition and adding to it. And I think there are many such institutions in our country still. They are denigrated, obviously, by a lot of people, but people are instinctively drawn to them, and I think those are the sort of things which should provide the Conservatives with their major causes. And if you ask why young people join the military, for example, it's partly for this sort of reason, the desire to affirm something and to belong to something. We should just make that more available than it is, that feeling. You find this in America, that feeling is widely available. Of course, as you know, it's not available in universities, but there is some hope that universities will close down soon. rival forms of education will be born in their place. You know, if there were a little college in the centre of London, of which I was master and you dean,
fine place.
Yes, we would very soon have a little assembly of somewhat bewildered people whom we would take in the hand, and it would grow, and it would not be a university. It would be something which, as was founded in the Middle Ages when the monasteries first got going. People need those communities outside the family, but inside society, which take on the business of education, the business of passing on a culture, the business of creating art, music, poetry, and so on. It was wonderful what happened then. Not everything was good, of course, but it was a spontaneous birth of something which made a civilization. And there's no reason why it shouldn't happen again.
No, and there are, as you said, there are positive signs in the American Academy, where I think of the three main universities in America which have had major scandals over what one might now call wokeness, which I'm sure most of you are familiar with this term now, they're all suffering admissions problems as a result. Brett Weinstein's former university, at Evergreen, ever since they chased him and his family off campus for doing nothing wrong. They've got terrible admissions problems. Middlebury College, since Charles Murray was meant to speak and the female professor who was with him was physically assaulted and hospitalized, Middlebury's got having to accept it's got fewer people applying this year than before. And so I would say the harsh bit of this, but which must be pushed, is that these people must realize that there is a price to pay for not educating people.
Yes.
And that there is no reason why an American family should remortgage their house to send their son or daughter away to become stupider.
Yes.
But as you say, the positive bit of that is that we have... It's not as if we're starting from year zero.
No. But this is a very important point, though. We need the freedom to create new institutions, and that's where the danger lies. For instance, in this imaginary college that you and I could set up tomorrow, we could produce a degree course in Western culture, which everybody would love to take, and we could then go on to give degrees. But those degrees would not be ratified. We would need a royal charter to provide them, and the royal charter would have to come through all the apparatus of ignorant lefties who control these things. Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't, only if, so there's a freedom that we wouldn't have. And I say this because I'm part of Buckingham University, which has, of course, had a huge difficulty in getting off the ground precisely because there was a political prejudice against it. Such a place could not be educational if it was not teaching the standard Marxist doctrines.
One of the worst things about this case you just mentioned in Cambridge in recent days with this young researcher who's been dispensed with by the college was the fact that the justification that the students had for wanting him to go was that they found his research offensive. And I mean, my
all
own
research is,
of course, the truth is often offensive, usually. And the idea, but I thought that the idea that for the first time a university had thought that offending somebody was a reason to therefore ruin somebody's career and get rid of them was an unbelievably ominous.
I mean, this. Remember, though, that there's this great distinction between giving offence and taking offence. And we're living in a culture where people become experts in taking offence.
Yes.
Even when it hasn't been given, you know, and that's what is taught in gender studies.
Yes.
It teaches young women to take offense at every remark a man might make, or even his being there, you know. It's a wonderful theatrical thing to take offense, but it doesn't lead to any lasting relationships.
At the Scruton Murray College, it will be illegal to take gender studies. Because, of course, it isn't. Of course, this is the problem with a lot of these so-called social sciences. They're not sciences. They're not actually a discipline. It's just a political indoctrination to make people bitterer than they were when they went in. However, now we are going to have to go to the audience at some point. But can I just, before we do, suggest that we, if the people with microphones are available with the microphones already, what I suggest we do is that I point to people and we take maybe two or three at a go.
Yes.
And
then we carry on talking on the strength of that.
Yes, exactly. So we don't need the lights up, but just vaguely make sure you sort of wave meaningfully, and maybe we'll take some there, since there's a microphone near there anyway. And could I just remind you, I'm not saying this just to be offensive, but I always like to stress that questions are not autobiographies, and they're usually one sentence with a question mark at the end.
Well, thanks very much for your talk. I feel like I've quite a good idea of what a conservative domestic policy is, but I'd like to hear your thoughts, because I think the two of you might possibly even differ on what you'd consider a conservative foreign policy to be.
Good. And another one near that gentleman, maybe. Somebody there. Somebody's got a piece. Yep, why not?
Hi there. Hi. Good to see you again, Roger. I know you're going to Brazil in next month. Wonder, what kind of message are you bringing to Brazil? As you know, we elected, and I'm sorry, I'm Brazilian, but it was not my fault. You know that we elected the first conservative president ever. So what kind of message are you bringing to Brazil? Thank you.
It's an important question, but maybe we'll have one other to add to this mix. The gentleman behind with a piece of paper in the air.
I was once a Conservative Member of Parliament, and I was also an army officer. I'd like to ask whether you've had any apology from James Brokenshire or Mr. Mercer or Mr. Tugendhat, who must now understand that they fired you on a completely false steer and behaved quite disgracefully. Have you heard anything from anybody?
What a good question.
Well, I might as well take that last question first.
You're leaving Brazil to me. What? That doesn't quite seem fair.
No, I have had a very nice letter from Tom Tugendhat.
Oh, yes, he has written finally.
Yes, which was apologetic, and I replied to it in the same friendly spirit. I never read what he said, because I don't look at that stuff. Obviously, I've had no apology from Mr. Mercer. And my relations with Brokenshire are complex, to say the least. I say there has been no apology. There's been a letter explaining in some way, but I wrote back to that and said, you know, that's not really adequate. So I would like to, I wait for an apology, but I don't expect to get one, because apologies are very costly, and they require you to see yourself from outside and cast judgment on yourself, and most people find that very difficult. I've given up on putting any pressure, but I think it would have been right to apologize, because it would have helped me, for one thing. I would have survived very much more readily if that was publicly known, and it would then be clear that I...
He did do that extraordinary modern political move of saying that he thought things could have been done better. I can never understand why they don't realize there's a difference between that and saying sorry.
Well, if I'd been shot, that would have been much more effective.
Yes. Yes, I did think of... Sorry, I did think Peter Hitchens made a fantastic point in the Mail on Sunday a couple of weeks ago in writing about your case, when he said about Mr. Tugendhat and Mercer, he said that neither of them pass up an opportunity to remind us of their military service. Peter Hitchens said, "I've met braver pacifists."
Well, I don't think we should
Brazil.
This platform to denigrate people, really.
No,
the message I'll be taking...
You're so much nicer than I am. I can do it all night.
I've lived longer than you, that's the thing.
Yes, it's true. It's true.
The message I would take to Brazil is make sure I get on that plane to get back. Meanwhile, see a bit of the country and not say anything that can be misreported on social media. And just be myself. Now, whether I can be myself in that climate, I don't know. We'll see. I know that I have a lot of fans in Brazil. All my books get translated into Portuguese. That suggests that it's not a very normal place. And that there must be some deep existential crisis going on. But whether I can satisfy that crisis, I don't know.
And foreign policy, yes, you're right. It would be hard to know where the difference might be unless we thought of a sort of concrete example. It's hard to say what a conservative foreign policy would be at the moment. My own view is that it wouldn't be, for instance, ring-fencing international aid spending and not the military budget. It seems a very strange thing to do. But it has to be a sort of case-by-case basis, I'd have thought. And on intervention, it depends where.
I would say that our foreign policy towards Europe is misguided. That it is taking Germany and France as the principal parties to be appeased and negotiated with, whereas our friends are in Eastern Europe. And I think we need a much more positive approach to those countries in order to help them to build themselves up for our own good too, because after all they're all fleeing to us, and we can't cope with the overweight of population in our country. And I think many would want to go back and build up those countries, Poland especially, and Hungary. These are places which are essentially deeply friendly to us in the way that Germany and France never will be. And they are the way of balancing the European Union's centrist policy, making it more friendly to the cause of national identity.
Yes.
Let's go over this side, the glut of hands, and where's the microphone? Yes, just grab the first person, or give them the microphone anyway. Yeah.
Hi. I'd imagine most of our MPs, most of our Conservative MPs and the Prime Minister would disagree with very little of what's been said tonight. So what are they trying to achieve by sort of pretending that there's a difference between themselves and the two of you up there?
Good. And nearby, just somebody on the other side of the aisle, maybe, or a few rows back. Yeah.
Hello. I'm interested in the future of conservatism. I have a 17-year-old son who is not left-thinking. And what do you say to him, who could be your future, our future, about standing up to ideology, and where are his rock stars to bring forward in front of his friends?
Good question. And whoever you see.
Hi. I'm a 16-year-old student.
Ah.
And I'd like to say that I'd be the first to join your Scruton Murray College.
Fantastic.
Is there any hope that you could offer me if I would like to go to university to study the humanities, or is there no hope whatsoever?
Right.
Oh, golly.
Do you want to deal with these?
Okay. Firstly, maybe I'll leave MPs to you. I think that their aim is to get by in office without anyone noticing they're conservatives. And I have to say, let me give you one very concrete example of that. I think I wrote this in Spectator the other week, but, you know, when Labour were in power, they put people who were left-wing in every single public body in this country. They're still there. They're still there like... it's not even like snipers up the trees after a retreating army. It's just they are still holding on to the terrain. And... by comparison, after we'll soon be 9 years of majority conservative rule in this country, some people point to the success of William Shawcross having been twice appointed to the Charity Commission, and then there was a second success with Roger Scruton being appointed to the Building Beautiful Commission, and that's sort of what they've got to show for public appointments after 9 years in office. And I think that tells you an awful lot. They tend to say, oh, well, conservatives don't put themselves forward for these appointments. Well, they should make it easier for conservatives to put themselves forward for such appointments. It should not be the case still that if you go to almost any public institution in this country, you find someone who once wrote speeches for Tony Blair or Robin Cook leading it. And I'm afraid that is still the case. And that tells you an awful lot about the actual lack of ideological commitment of some of the MPs. Very quickly, I mean, the two questions on that. There is hope, absolutely, and there are, for all the things we've said about them, some extraordinary universities in this country still, with extraordinary portions and departments within them. Great individual lecturers. And I think that here, as in America, you have to find them out and just research beforehand whether you're going to find somebody who's really going to inspire you and give you access to this whole world. I mean, Alan Bloom, I think, once said that your university years are your charmed years. You know, they stand between the years of ignorance and the intellectual wasteland most people go into in adulthood. And so you don't want to waste these years. You don't, particularly don't want to waste them being political. You want to have the best opportunity that culture will ever have to get to you or you to it. And it is there. You just have to choose and see your way through carefully, which goes to the same question that the lady asked about her son. I mean, he probably will, if he's not left-wing now, he probably will be for a bit. but he may, like me, spend a matter of hours on the left. and be over it by lunchtime. So, and there are lots of... it's not as if just now, but living and dead, so many people to read, to look up to absorb. Just an unbelievable inheritance of things to know about and yes. to not repudiate.
I totally agree with that. One shouldn't disparage all the universities just because the vociferous part of them is so difficult. Obviously, you have to look around. Both my children are at Oxford and loving it. And it doesn't seem to be taking away the fragments of knowledge that I sent them there with. And it might even be adding to them. So, I'm content with that.
There's maybe a middle bit. Oh, no, maybe we'll go to the back. Okay, and there's an audience uprising at the back.
Yes. Amandeep Singh Bogle, a Conservative MEP candidate for Northern Ireland. Sir Roger, first of all, may I add, I think it was absolutely disgraceful the way you were hounded out of government, off your position, by literally a Twitter mob. Talking of Twitter, I get a stream of abuse literally every day on Twitter, calling me things from House Negro to Tory Houseboy to a variety of other things from leftists engaged in identity politics. Now, I came to this country as an 8-year-old, as an immigrant, and I made it my own, and it made me her own. What do you have to say about politics of identity?
Very good question. Yes. Such a good question. Maybe somebody else at the back, or two other people at the back. Maybe one of the people, there's a lady with a yellow thing on, waving vociferously, and right at the back. Yes.
Thank you.
A man. But it's yellow. I got the colour right.
I'm reassured by your recognition of my voice, so thank you. Thank you for that.
It would have been worse if I'd said yes, madam, after you spoke.
Indeed, indeed. And I'm not saying it hasn't happened before. But, but anyway, Sir Roger, I just want to ask you one question. Why did you call Douglas harmless?
Oh. Gosh.
Yeah.
I don't know how you're going to answer that. One person else nearby there.
I teach at a music college in London. My students, I love them, but they are all terribly woke and left-wing. Now, they get their news feed not from newspapers or The Spectator, but from their Google news feed. Mm. Most of this is the BBC and The Guardian. The right-wing news media, if I hardly like to call The Spectator right-wing, it's just sensible. And the good thing about The Spectator, you have opposing points of view. It has a paywall. And this seems to me, I wonder whether you'd agree, this is a problem. They just never hear an opposing view. And they've learnt their dogma, their catechism of wokeness off by heart.
Yes. I can feel obviously there's a great agreement about with that. Let me just take these questions one after, so they're obviously addressed to me. The question about identity politics. I agree that there is something wrong with identity politics as we now perceive it. What seems to be wrong is that people seize an oppositional identity always. Say, I am this thing, whatever it might be, transgender, woman, anything, with which I oppose the rest of you. You know, I'm standing for that against you all. And they don't take hold of the identity that would reconcile them with others, as you have done beautifully as an immigrant, said, look, I'm adopting the identity of this country that has taken me in and which I warm towards. And that is what we should be putting in the place of identity politics, the real identity, the identity that we share, rather than the one that puts us at loggerheads with each other. And I think that, again, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier. Resentment is so much easier than love. You know, love requires you to forgive the faults of the other, to be giving and forgiving, whereas hatred has no cost at all. And that's what we see on the in these Twitter storms and so on. And that's why I say that Douglas is harmless, because, you know, however much he is an agent provocateur, his actual nature, as I know, is one that is founded on this respect for others and this desire to belong with others and to negotiate and discuss with them. So you have ultimately a conciliatory nature, which has been, as it were, bullied into aggression by people who don't share that with you. So that's why I say Douglas is harmless. Of course, I don't want him to be harmless all the time. In fact, he's been great in fighting on my behalf. On the woke students in the music college, this is a real problem because, of course, one of the things that sparked off in me the real sense of belonging to a civilization and a culture to which I owed everything was music. Mm. And the same was true for Douglas, I'm sure. And my music master at school and my piano teacher and all those, they were immersed in this culture, and it was a form of belonging, which again was harmless because it was part of the culture all around, which embraced everyone. And it changed my mind and my emotions and everything to be immersed in our musical tradition in the way that I have been. Unfortunately, young people today, however musical they may be, are not brought up with that sense of immersion in a public musical culture that has endured down the centuries. It's much more the aggressive backdrop of the pop song, which has been standard fare. So I think that doesn't help them to find an identity of belonging to the larger community. That's not the whole story, of course. And this is one of the things that I'm sure everybody in this room is worried by. How do we bring young people generally back to recognize that the world is greater than the narrow and ever more narrow little sphere which their screens are shepherding them into?
If I could just add to that, I mean, bring two of those together, that slightly what I said to the young lady at the front, that, of course, if young people aren't introduced to this at school, if they don't, for instance, know what the greatness of the musical canon is or the literary canon, then it's highly unlikely they are going to, of their own volition, discover it in adulthood. Mm. It's the best. It might not be the only chance, but it's certainly the best. Of course, they can discover a lot of the other things, including the pop culture. That's going to come anyway, which is why it's always so soul-destroying when you discover a music teacher teaching the pop songs to children, because that means they're not going to get to Bach, and they're going to miss everything that will come from it. And I think one of the saddest things for me, at any rate, is what I describe as the politicization of everything, is the politicization almost increasingly of the arts. If you listen to Radio 3 now, everything is being played through the feminist lens at the moment. Yes. They keep stressing, this soprano role is sung by a woman. It's a woman's role, and a strong woman has to sing, and so on and so forth. And yes, no, we get it. And then you have these strange intrusions of wokeness into the arts. You know, the proms insisting on a 50-50 gender equality of composers by, I think, 2021 or something. And then The Guardian running a piece the other day about the terrible whiteness of the British poetry scene. You think the British poetry scene's not like such a dominant patriarchal rampaging or entity that it deserves this additional decimation by identity politics, anyhow, maybe... if we have any sonneteers, they can speak up now. Maybe this, roughly, this bank here.
I was wondering, to what extent do you think conservatives can make common cause with those on the left who emphasise more what they might call communitarian instincts, who value localism, community, civil society, people of the sort of blue labour movement, if you want to call it that, and therefore see conservatism as something which isn't just a left-right issue, but can be sold across that traditional divide?
Mm. Very good question. Somebody else nearby?
The title of this conversation is the Future of Conservatism. Do you think that the future of conservatism in the UK now is outside of the so-called Conservative Party?
Right. And one more equally terrible question. There's a gentleman there waving.
I have been had a great problem in finding any conservative policy in this conservative government. Could you think of any one item that they have actually passed or proposed to do which is actually conservative? To me, it all seems to be left of Blair.
any of those.
I'd like to respond to the first question, if I may, because that I think this is terribly important. Mm. I entirely agree that there is at the heart of conservatism is this idea of belonging to a community and, as it were, responding to that community with gratitude and a sense of membership and a sense of duty. And this is, of course, what Blue Labour wants to put at the forefront of its thinking. Obviously, someone like Maurice Glasman has made a very impressive start in doing that. So I am very much drawn to that. And also drawn to the idea that aspect of the political enterprise can be separated to a great extent from any commitment to a particular kind of economy. Although I'm very much in favour of the free market, I'm very suspicious of the globalised form of it. And the way in which it does not respond to the demands of local communities and local forms of value. So, and this is a problem for real conservatism, to develop an economic doctrine that does not menace the local communities on which we all depend. So, and I think Blue Labour is doing a great job here, and it is very much a conservative movement within the Labour Party, and they hate it. Mm. So it must be good. I don't the
conservative policies. Any spring to mind?
Well, I'll leave the real questions about the future of the party to you. I think that there are. There are no conservative policies that I can immediately call to mind, but except that for the brief time when Michael Gove was Minister of Education, when he set up the free schools and tried to recapture education from the educationists, which is essentially what needs to be done, to return it to the parents. To those who really have a sense of responsibility towards the children. And I think, actually, Michael Gove, wherever he tends to be, does perform a radical conservative shake-up. Mm-hmm. So I think we should not dismiss them all by any means. And, of course, much of conservatism, on my view, is not about having policies, but about avoiding them. Mm. You know... Our greatest prime minister, in my view, Lord Salisbury, was in office for 20 years, and nobody can remember him. that surely is the archetype of the Conservative politician.
This does play against the natural instinct of politicians, of course.
Oh, yeah.
Tie a couple of those together. It seems to me that there is already an extraordinary association forming, mainly, you might say, in the north of England, but between natural Labour voters, or people who were for a long time Labour voters, and an element of the Conservative Party, or a breakaway element of it. I mean, I've been quietly rejoicing in recent days at the videos of the change meetings, which look like a sort of carriage clock makers meeting in a Travelodge hotel, which the various people who are running that party have to pretend are rallies, but they're not. Small congregations, and comparing those with these extraordinary rallies of the Brexit Party in the north of England, which are genuinely seem to be impulsive, sort of ground-up rebellions. Now, I don't know myself. I mean, this will be something we'll all be thinking about in the months and so on ahead. I desperately, like most people, want this country to heal from the Brexit debate, and cannot bear us having the Brexit debate for the rest of our lives. But if two parties pretend to offer Brexit and don't, then obviously people will go elsewhere. And I think there's an interesting thing happening, which is that both the main parties are at a position where they could split in some significant way over this. I don't know what I feel about that in a way, other than that it is to some extent exciting that the Conservative Party might not be able to blackmail us with Jeremy Corbyn and just say, you have to vote for us or Jeremy Corbyn. Because I think that the vote has to matter more than that. It can't just be one of the central insights of conservatism seems to me that people are loyal to institutions that are loyal to them, that it's a reciprocal arrangement. And the Conservative Party demands loyalty of people to whom it shows no loyalty itself. We've probably got time for one more bank of questions. Let's say I've sort of ignored people in the front for elitist reasons or anti-elitist reasons or something. Maybe there's a gentleman here as well, and there's a couple there. And
I asked a question to Roger Scruton about, isn't the public body that he was fired from fundamentally a socialist entity? And why would he want to be part of nationalizing the concept of beauty?
Outflanking Scruton from the right. another person here, and then somebody, yes, a lady there, and then a gentleman at the front, as I promised.
The great slogans for conservatism are probably to be found in the New Testament. Do you think that conservatism or enlightened classical liberalism is fatally wounded without Christianity?
Oh, very good question. Gentlemen.
So, Douglas, best leader of the Conservative Party, Theresa May or Roger Scruton? Question for Roger. I'm not making this up. My next event tonight is being addressed by James Brokenshire. Any message for him?
Now, what order do you want to take them in?
I think the first one I ought to deal with is, isn't it the whole idea of taking hold of the housing market and turning it in the direction of beauty? Isn't that like nationalising the idea of beauty and imposing the dictatorship of the state from above? I think many people have felt that. Shouldn't we open this to the people and let people build what they want, where they want, and how they want? This connects very closely with the question about the communitarians and blue labour. You can't defend communities simply by letting the market loose upon them. I think this has been this is part of the story of Europe in the modern world, that we've inherited a very complex civilization, which is to a great extent dependent upon legislation from above, and dependent upon a culture of knowledge and expertise which isn't necessarily available to everyone. You travel around France and you visit these beautiful towns and villages, and you ask yourself the question, you know, how wonderful that these things exist. How did it happen? It didn't happen just because people build like that. It happened because people believed in the place they were building and also believed in controlling each other to make sure that individuals didn't spoil those places. And that was the spirit of our planning law as it came into full flight after the Second World War. We have inherited something beautiful, a wonderful, beautiful country and beautiful towns within it, and we must pass on this inheritance, not spoil it. And that means building in the right way. And our planning laws were designed to achieve that. The problem is there's money to be made out of ugliness. Indeed, ugliness is more remunerative than beauty, or has been in recent times, partly because of the collapse of education in the architecture schools, the relentless, indeed socialist propaganda of architectural modernists, saying that, you know, we must build for the people and build without all these fancy ornaments and all these luxuries that the middle class are looking for. Build in concrete and steel and glass in straight lines and then shove the buggers into it. And that was the post-war policy, and that's how I see socialism in this market. Not as a gesture of freedom, but the wrong kind of control. The question is to get the right kind of control and one that is harmonious with the free market in individual properties. Very hard. That's what I was thinking about. But there we are.
I think we should finish on the Christianity question, but maybe the gentleman at the front, obviously Roger Scruton over Theresa May for Prime Minister, although I would ask for a portfolio in the Cabinet. And I was at something with Andrew Roberts the other day where a politician sort of said to Andrew Roberts, well, of course, let's say that Andrew Roberts is Prime Minister, and Andrew very generously said, the first thing I do is make Douglas Minister for Culture and Public Enlightenment. And I said, and war. So we agreed this was a very good new portfolio, which I'd also ask in the first part of the Scruton administration. The lady raises an incredibly important question we actually haven't got around to this evening. The role of Christianity in our culture. We're obviously coming apart from it or away from it, but we don't know what we're going to.
Well, we have inherited from the Enlightenment the idea that religion is essentially a private affair, even if we do have this formal official religion in this country. It is not imposed upon us in any particularly emphatic way, but it's the legacy of thinking and feeling and of moral being is still there with us, and it's inherited by all our institutions, and the attempt to dispense with it does hollow out those institutions, leave them spiritually vacant. And it's up to people of faith to try and fill them again. And you can only do that from your own heart. You can't do that by asking a minister to impose it for you. And my view is that Christians are called to do this. And the more Christians there are, the more likely it is that it will happen. And that, so I think one shouldn't despair. You know, we're in the same situation as the Christians in the catacombs. And we have to keep the light burning down there.
T.S. Eliot is somebody who's always mattered a great deal to both of us, which I think we've both credited him with a lot of our own spark, perhaps one might say. I always think of that passage in the Four Quartets, what's it... He tells us that what there is left to discover by strength and submission has already been discovered once or twice or several times by men whom one cannot hope to emulate. But there is no competition, there is only the fight to recover what has been lost and found and lost again and again, and now under conditions that seem unpropitious, but perhaps neither gain nor loss. For us there is only the trying, the rest is not our business.
Well, well done, Douglas.
Now, I think probably the clock tells us it's 8:30, at which point we're meant to finish speaking. But is there anything that's on your mind that we haven't covered, or
not really, just everything else. But thank you to the audience for being so sympathetic.
Yes, I think I'd like to say just thank you to you, because there are quite a lot of things you can do in London on a Wednesday, Tuesday evening, Tuesday. And for us, at any rate, to see you all here, it means an enormous amount. And I think in itself is a sign of great hope, because it shows how many people care about ideas and about conservatism and about the culture. And so I, at any rate, would like to finish by thanking you. And wish you all a very good night.
Yes, me too.